Welcome to Tech and Law Insights, the show where builders, lawyers, and policy folks meet. This is episode 9, and I'm your host, Rupa. This podcast is sponsored by Lurie.ai, tools for everyone, not just lawyers. Today's guest is Erica Shoemate, AI and Tech Policy and Strategy Leader. Erica is the former Trust and Safety Policy Head at Twitter, Amazon Global Display and Sponsored Ads Policy, former National Security and Intelligence Leader at the FBI, and currently an AI 2030 Global Policy Fellow. Erica is a widely trusted voice across national security and public impact technology. Erica, thank you for being our guest for episode 9.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to talk more about my background and also just really to be a different kind of voice that maybe your listeners have not heard before. So I can't wait to have this conversation.
Likewise. Let's just get started. Let me get started with a question. So for our listeners to understand your background and what motivated you to essentially become a disruptor at the intersection of technology and policy. I'm wondering, and for our listeners, could you talk about what led you into working in national security at the FBI and later into trust and safety and artificial intelligence policy?
Yeah, great questions. So for your listeners, so I like to give like some good historical context. So I, again, as you mentioned, my name is Erica Shoemate, and I am a first generation college grad, also an inner city kid, originally from Memphis, Tennessee, and a DC area transplant for the last 13 years. And never in a million years would I have fathomed the career I've had so far. Like, I've always been very intentional about where I wanted my life to go. Didn't always know exactly how I would get there. Again, you know, not having anyone before me in my family, no roadmap, but I always knew that education was going to be my ticket to a world that was completely different from anything I had ever seen before. And so to just kind of pivot into like, well, how did I get into national security? How did I get to the FBI? What I knew was I always wanted to be in DC, and I made that happen through some of the work that I had done in my undergraduate, which I graduated from Ole Miss, and I earned my Bachelor of Paralegal Studies. And I also worked at the time I was getting my degree for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Mississippi as a student clerk. And that really exposed me to working with all the various agencies, you know, law enforcement as well, and also seeing people in and out working with the court systems, the federal court systems, et cetera. And I was just so intrigued in being able to sit down and having real conversations about how does, you know, the federal government or federal law enforcement and also the intelligence world, how they all like work together and what does that look like for my community? And so we had, there was various like initiatives that were happening at the time. And I always knew that I wanted to go into public service. And I thought initially, it's funny, like your guests may find this interesting, being that this is about, you know, tech and law. I always thought I was going to go to law school, actually. And I pivoted and decided I was going to get my master's in public administration. And so I attended actually Arkansas State University, had a phenomenal MPA program that was also very small. And there is where I created the opportunity of like, okay, where do I see myself long term? And I was able to have an internship under the Washington Center internship program. And I earned a scholarship with them. And I was the first student out of Arkansas, in any Arkansas college or university, to have this scholarship. And I was one of three people in the nation that earned the Pi Sigma Alpha Honor Society scholarship. And so needless to say, my internship was with the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is another DOJ agency. And so you think about like, oh, how do we get there? I ultimately had the opportunity to meet with the director that is formerly the Victims Assistance Services Division at the FBI. And I was so intrigued by being able to interview her as a part of my portfolio. for one of the courses I was taking for my internship program. And that really opened like a whole different perspective for me, particularly working with victims. And a lot of times the victims that I understood and working back at the U.S. Attorney's Office at the time, a lot of those victims looked like me and my community, unfortunately. And I'm an empath naturally, and being able to enter into the national security space, I knew exactly what I wanted to do was to protect the margins in the communities that are often erased or not fully thought about in a positive light, and bringing a different perspective and not just a stereotype around the interactions between federal law enforcement and intelligence, and how we as my own community are seen in these spaces. And also I can't, you know, let me go by saying that also I was a kid that saw and remember everything about my day on 9/11. And that actually was something that was always in the back of my mind. Like, I remember exactly what I was doing when it happened. I was literally a freshman in college, like barely 3 weeks in. And when it happened, I was just, you know, it was just shocking, quite frankly. And so by the time I finished graduate school, all these things, I also knew again that I was going to do something in the public service. But the opportunity to work for the FBI was one that really I did not see coming, quite frankly. But they were also recruiting more and more intelligence analysts to build out a very, at the time, immature program. And I was like, this will be great. I get to, like, you know, possibly live in DC and all of these things. And I also get to be a part of something that really is about keeping the people, our people as a whole in this nation, country safe, and also being able to do something for the greater good and do it in a way that I had never seen myself in this space before. So I know it's a long-winded response, but that's really kind of like that kind of pivot in like, how did I get into this space? It wasn't like I had an intelligence program in college or anything like that, but it was just kind of like the path of me getting into public service and not fully knowing exactly where I would be until those opportunities presented itself.
Not at all. It's incredibly informative and like really inspiring. And so for professionals who are maybe later in their career or early on, and they didn't create those internship opportunities or kind of haven't had the chance to, and they want to pivot into national security, so this or AI policy. Do you have any advice for how they could break in to either of these sectors or both?
Absolutely. Yeah. One thing about me is that I would definitely say I am the queen of career pivots. I'm a recently diagnosed neurospicy individual as well. Mm-hmm. And so understanding, like, at the time I did not have this information about how my brain was wired, but I always had a love for things related around like moving fast, these environments, and like meeting people. One of my superpowers is being a connector and being able to relate to people, being able to influence. And so for those who are thinking about, you know, national security and as a potential career, especially now as you know, priorities are changing, the world is changing, especially in this emerging technology kind of rapid, you know, evolution we're having. And I would, you know, easily say, one, there is no one particular major career, or if you're thinking about someone that is later in life and maybe they're mid-career, the one thing I would say is, I know you hear this before, but like networking, beyond like networking is great, but being intentional and calculated around what networking looks like. And networking doesn't mean you need to go to every, you know, big event, every big happy hour. Networking can also be taking the chance that on something that may be uncomfortable, cold reaching out to people on LinkedIn, people that you might follow on LinkedIn that are in the space and you want, you're curious of how they got to where they are. And like for me, I'm always big on relationships. Relationships definitely matter. And I don't mean transactional relationships. I mean, building that rapport and getting to know the people that you maybe you want to emulate, or people that you find pretty fascinating in a world that you may be interested in. Because for me, I always could see like where my skills were transferable, but I would say to your audience, that was not always easy for the other side of the people or the teams that were interviewing me to see. And how I made myself relevant, and this is, I think, a great point for people who are considering pivoting, is if you are in the public service, you really have to think about how can I make whatever speak I'm in industry-wise, whether that's, you know, public service, nonprofit, how do I turn my transferable skills in the language that I am accustomed to speaking, as far as like from a professional lens, how do I make that palatable to the professional landscape I want to go into? For example, I was in national security and intelligence. Okay, well, how do you make that relevant to pivoting into to tech policy? And for me, I think that those things are very much interconnected, but there was a lot of pushback as I worked to pivot on understanding how is it that national security and tech policy, how are they even in the same worlds? And so what I did was I literally started to iterate on my narrative of who I was and what I brought. Like, example of, I have worked a multifaceted of programs, from counterterrorism, counterintelligence, from the cyberspace, from also all the different intelligence ints, as we call them, how you get information. And so what I did to bring it home from, because I was at Twitter, social media platform, was saying the job of anyone in the federal public service, and particularly those that are investigations and or intelligence, is to, we're supposed to defend the Constitution and also protect the American people, right? And when we think about what for-profit companies want to do, they also want to protect their users so that their users will continue to use their platform, right? And how I brought those two things together was saying that I understand policy at a level that most people would never even fathom, not only for the US, but also from a global perspective, because my career, although very, you know, US country first, I've also spent time operating overseas and understand that diplomacy does matter. And when you bring it back to a user base from a profit standpoint, we also know that it is important for users to feel safe on platforms, transparency as well. And so I was able to really leverage those skills in that intersection, and also humanizing things that people care about. If you want to talk about global events, depending on what platform you are on, or current events that matter, like, you know, Twitter 1.0 at the time, as I call it, was definitely what we would call the town square, right? If you wanted to get real information in real time, it was there for you to see, right? And I was able to show how me having to get rapid, you know, being in an environment where I'm looking at rapid information and trying to make a decision very quickly in real time, or provide a recommendation to executives in real time, it's really the same thing. Also, from an election safety standpoint, I was able to bring in my experience from my intelligence background of how and why it's important that, you know, we have this election safety. Like, we may understand it at a tactical level, but strategically, we should also be thinking about it, if you're going to look at for-profit, on why it's important to protect how we are thinking about elections, not only in particular cycles, but also long-term. And so I was able to really gel my previous experience in a way that was in layman's speak in the tech format for those that I was sitting across and trying to become part of their team or their companies.
That's really cool. And you really build a lot of responsible AI, as you've mentioned.
Yeah,
I've read that from some of your work. And how do you actually, for the builders in our audience, how do you actually measure that or qualitatively or quantitatively measure that as you're building tech? For our builders.
Yeah, I know. Great question. So when I made the pivot from the FBI into tech, one of the things that I had the amazing opportunity to do as the head of site policy for Twitter Americas was focused on safety and cybercrime. And I worked very closely with the product and engineering teams that were building the large language models or the machine learning as a part of like automating how we were able to take the policies that were being created and implement those actually into the technology to be able to create the space of ensuring user safety. And some of the policies that, you know, you think about when you're on various platforms is they say safety, but if you dig a bit deeper or go even just a layer below, you're thinking about, you know, the abusive behaviors, hate speech, self-harm, crimes against children or CSAM, it also is called, and also violent organizations, you know, terrorist organizations. Also being at Twitter at a time when the Ukraine-Russia conflict it broke out, and being part of the team that was responsible for creating and releasing, or I should say disseminate, the policy focused on prisoner wars, and which was like not even heard of for very, you know, modern technology, having to even create something of that regard. And as we think about the builders of this, the biggest thing is going back to the company's like goal or mission or vision. And for me, it's always been balancing the freedom of expression, right? Working to mitigate on and offline platform harm, which is a very delicate dance. And I would say, I think that it is unfortunately unrealistic to think that we can mitigate all harm, but I think that we can minimize harm, especially to those who are the least representative, but the most likely to be impacted by harm. And that requires not only the design, it also requires there to be a multifaceted layer and diverse teams, quite frankly, to ensure that we're thinking about our own, the bias we bring to the table, our own lived experiences that we bring to the table. And that was something that I was able to do in a way that I didn't have to scream, all the fun, all the DEI words that now, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, I can't say. So I really just humanized the systems that I was a part of. And when I'm talking to the builders and you talk about responsible AI, I'm always thinking about, okay, like at the very, let's say, neutral level, we want to ensure that people aren't being harmed by this great technology that has been created, as I call it, you know, it's always about this product innovation. And product innovation is always good until it's not. And that is where I was able to have those conversations with product and engineering teams and say, hey, we shouldn't launch this until we have this part, right? Because if we don't think about and test and incubate on this first, while this product, it sounds great, it could very well be something where I would call an unforced error, and it could be a lot of blowback also for the company. And so when we talk about responsible AI, we also must remember that we check our own biases for those who are in this space, and also take a look at your table of the people who are the creators and ask the people that are using your product, are those the same people that have an opportunity to have a voice at your table? And so, and when you talk about being a professional disruptor, I am so unapologetic and unafraid to say that out loud. I don't care how big the person is in the room, the executive, it's like, if we're going to be honest and we want to build and we want to say we want to be inclusive, we want these type of targeted users, and or these are the type of users that are using our platform, then it is our job as a company to protect those very users and do everything that we can to create guardrails in our policies, not just the legal policy. Like, there, I strongly believe that there's a difference between the legal requirements as it relates to product innovation, and then also the requirements for the user experience, and not just the terms of service, right? It's everything that I just, you know, mentioned earlier. And also thinking about, it's important to take a look at the data, to your point of how do you think about responsible AI and if something is working. And for me, and all the roles that I've had in these spaces, it is a very much so a qualitative perspective. And I think that sometimes companies are so used to like quantitative, and it's kind of hard to measure the actual policy. That is where you do need, you know, perspectives from those can be, you know, NGOs, that can be people in civil society, or setting up a council, like we had Trust and Safety Council, that can provide some of that qualitative analysis that you're looking for, some of the additional like anecdotes, people that are actually using it, because policy at times is not going to always give you a one-to-one data. And I believe that companies make a major mistake by looking for specific numbers to say that this is doing well or this is not doing well as it relates to policy implementation. And I think that it, qualitative and quantitative have to work hand in hand when we think about policy, because policy impacts real people and real lives.
For products that you've built, for example, Twitter, you have worked as a leader for data and content governance to bring about the best user experience possible, keep people safe, and move forward the AI technology field. And yeah, and that sort of role does, I can't imagine. I'm wondering if you can share a leadership habit that kept you steady in tough seasons.
Oh man, oof, that's a good one. Yeah, definitely a lot of tough seasons these days. I would definitely say for me, it is me saying to myself, it's even on my phone, actually, I am enough. May sound very simple, but when you are in these roles, particularly for your listeners, I am a Black woman, as I mentioned earlier. I am also a first generation college grad, and not knowing what I don't know, that imposter syndrome can be real. But I also understand that the depth and breadth of what I know, it's not topical. If you were to go deep with me on various topics, I can literally go deep. And so reminding myself that even in moments where it, where someone may be, maybe have a different, you know, perspective, that it's okay to stand on my own perspective with the facts and also with my lived experience, and being able to think about what is the outcome that we want, whether that is a business bottom line or from a personal standpoint, that I, regardless of whatever decision I make, that I can actually look myself in the mirror and be like, that was the right call, that was right for the moment, regardless of whether, you know, people fully agreed or disagreed with it. And at the end of the day, I'm big on my integrity and my values and everything that I do as a leader. I do not have a motive as it relates to like an agenda. Like, a lot of times people get into leaderships and it can definitely be about power. It can be self-centered. And me as a leader, I'm always thinking about the people that I'm leading, that I'm leading alongside, and how is it that what decision I make can impact them. And also, when a decision that I make, I know is not going to be popular, how do I help to message that in a way that can be received and understood regardless of agreement? And that leads me back to the core of I am enough. And I am enough is really built off my resilience, my character, my perseverance, and all the things that I've had to navigate in my personal and professional life. And so when I wake up every day as a leader, and also having my own and building out my own boutique policy and consulting firm, I'm always big on waking up and saying, I'm grateful. I am enough. I know who I am. I know what is important to me. I know that we always have to keep humans and human-centered, whatever we're doing, as first, and everything else will follow that, because then I know if I'm leading in that North Star, that I'm always going to be operating in my purpose and always knowing that I am enough.
That was very powerful. Thank you, Erica, for sharing.
Thank you.
A lot of like really successful leaders who are well-rounded yet have incredible depth in their fields and domains are always really pushing themselves. And I guess another piece of advice for leaders who may not always be the decision makers, mm-hmm. and especially given everything is changing in technology,
yes.
you highlighted the disproportionate impacts of layoffs in mm-hmm. tech mm-hmm. And other mm-hmm. verticals. Do you have any more advice for leaders? What should they actually do this and next quarter?
Oh my gosh. Great, great, great. I love it. Love it. I love it. So I wear a lot of hats, to be clear. I'm also a career pivot strategist. And so what I did, I have taken my again, queen of pivots, right? I've taken all of my professional and personal experience. And because I have been successful at pivoting in my careers, is at the top of the year when, you know, there was just so much happening, and also like the fast, you know, rapid layoffs and all the things that were happening in the public service. And with me living here in the DMV, I, you know, personally know people that were impacted and the ripple effect of that. And so as a result, I actually created workshops at the time, like, and I still do some of them, like free workshops around don't panic, pivot. And that was really to ensure that leaders, whether in leaders, I want to also let the audience know that leaders, you can lead from wherever you are, whether that's an actual named role or just from where you stand, whether that's an individual contributor or an actual people manager, right? And it's so important for me to help people navigate through very uncertain times, no matter where you are, you know, in your life, in whatever season that may come. And the don't panic pivot framework for me was something that I built in literally less than 48 hours. And I had my first free workshop literally President's Day of this year. And for those that are out there listening, I was literally providing not only tips and tricks, but also showing people how to leverage AI and like to be able to optimize their, not just the resume, because it's a tactical stuff, not just LinkedIn, because that's the tactical stuff, but also how to understand and value self first, like your own agency, right? Having your own personal brand, understanding that you are the talent, you are the asset in every way, because even with technology and the models being built, someone had to build them. And so for everyone, whether you've been laid off, you're a recent grad, you know, you're in law school, just graduated, whatever that might be, know that you still have skills that while it could be a saturated field, there is no one like you. You are always going to be one of one. And being able to take a look at who you are and what you bring at the table. And I know there are those that sometimes can doubt themselves. Well, what do I actually spring. And what does that look like? This is where I show leaders how to leverage generative AI, right? You can, you know, put into a GPT or whatever, Claude, and just really having a conversation about who you are and your skills. And also I balance that with like operational security, like you don't put your name, anything like that, but like giving a kind of a broad overview of who you are and what skills you think that you bring and what you have brought, and also any of your personal skills or volunteer skills, and putting that into a whole prompt and being able to ask, like, what roles would I be good for, or actually what industries, what area has a gap in the market for me or my skills. And this is a way that you don't have to be so paralyzed, because we know that panic, going back to my don't panic pivot, panic causes paralysis. We know this, but there's power in the pivot. And when you are leaning on your power, even in days where you don't feel like you have any power, because today just sucks, right? Goes back to what my point earlier, like for me, everything is tied. I am enough, even when I don't feel like I am enough. And being able to sit down and think about those things in real time, like what am I or who am I? What roles have I had, or what skills have I gained? Or if you can't think of everything, you can even prompt it to add on to what I mentioned just a moment ago about the skills I bring. And you won't be able to remember it all, maybe. But if you do, dump it all in, like almost like a brain dump. And you can specifically say brain dump. Now help me streamline my skills and expertise for a market that is seeking people like me. And where is the market analysis or market gap analysis as it relates to that? So that where I'm getting at ultimately is you can create your own consulting businesses or business consulting firm or one LLC. Even if you decided to go and, you know, have another 9-to-5, you know that you always have your LLC in your back pocket, no matter where the economy is. And for me, that's saying that I always will have a way to generate revenue and income opportunity and not be solely dependent upon my 9-to-5 or my everyday job. And I know that is a lot for people to swallow, because some people just don't want to do that. Everybody, you know, doesn't have the entrepreneurial spirit, and that's okay. However, we cannot sit and be doomed and gloomed. And we can have our pity party, and that's that. You are supposed to give yourself that grace. But when it is time to like pick yourself up, let's work through like, okay, how can I now pivot so that I can be able to feed myself, feed my family? And those are just little ways you can leverage AI to do that. And I know it can be scary. Like, well, how am I supposed to go find a client? That's using your network. Using LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a great resource. And sometimes it even is putting yourself out there and talk about what you offer through like a short 30-second video, whatever it is. But there are ways that even in this very difficult job market that you can distinguish yourself from others by one, betting on yourself, betting on your talent, figuring out the things that you are great at and that you wouldn't mind being able to do on a regular as a way for you to generate income. And also, most importantly, generate income, have impact, and also have a level of purpose that maybe you never even imagined before. So that's what I would definitely say to the leaders that are listening.
It's such an excellent philosophy on leadership potential within everyone. The desire for workers and leaders to make impact and really be purpose driven. I could say personally, it's a really timely explanation you gave. And thank you so much for that, Erica.
You're very welcome.
And for our last question today also is along the lines of agency, but just routing to the intersection of large language model applications and ChatGPT, as you've been talking about, and people using this tool. even to represent themselves and move themselves forward in legal situations that they're in.
And
and as people really take ownership of their personal situation and don't want to pay thousands of dollars for attorneys when, you know, they very well have the ability to enter courts now and sort of represent themselves even better than they were able to before with technology. Could you just talk a little bit more about your experience in this like development and and are there any guardrails we should insist on that can protect people as they represent themselves?
Yes, great, great question. And I know I talked about it very briefly about operational security and keeping your, you know, self safe. Yeah. So one thing that I am very big on, again, of course, coming from my previous life and career in national security, and also working in like major, like, you know, federal criminal space as well, is remember that AI is a tool. Like, it's a guide, not the gospel. AI does make mistakes, and AI is, you get out what you put in, right? So AI can make you be the most amazing person. You could even be a CEO by the time you're done with generative AI. But it's very important for those who are using it from a, you know, a more economical way for legal representation, because the reality is, I am speaking from personal experience, there's a thing called justice, and then there's a thing called my reality and access to justice and representation, right? And we know that, quite frankly, from a legal standpoint, attorneys can basically charge whatever they want, and that can immediately, in the past, have prevented many of us from even moving forward with, let's say, court systems or court cases. Or if you find yourself in trouble, you're like, oh my gosh, all I have is the public defender. And granted, there are some public defenders who are out there doing God's work, honestly. Mm-hmm. But they're also can be overwhelmed. And then there are those who are just like, it's just something else to do. But even with all of that, now you do have AI and how you can ensure that you are maintaining integrity of whatever the thing is that you are looking or using it for, is particularly like, let's say if you're trying to plan out, let's say if you are going to represent yourself in court, you know, kind of like your strategy and game plan of how you want to present your facts, your information. And the biggest thing is when you are using AI for those very reasons, or like the facts of your case, it's also important, I personally would say, from an operational security, just from a data and privacy standpoint, that you don't put exactly the exact thing you're going through, or if you put it in, making sure that you keep it like as anonymous as possible. You're speaking to it deep enough, but broad enough that it's not necessarily attributed back to you. So for example, let's say you're working through a family law situation, right? And it is around, let's say you have kids, it's custody or whatever. And we know of one, I would hope that, you know, you wouldn't put your kid's name in there, but definitely don't put your kid's name in there. Don't put your name in there. And instead of a certain city, put another city. It could be in the same state, but just a different city. And you can even go as far as, I'm big on brackets when I'm using AI, and a lot of times I'll just put XXX or like initials or something that will remind me, one, to go back and fill it in. And yet, two, I'm not giving away everything about me, right? Now, I'm not advertising for either, you know, type of platforms, but Claude, I know for a fact, does a great job with data and privacy. And it actually is big on like not, you know, keeping data and around its users. And so it's all about your comfort level as well. And like, you know, you have to understand, like, if I'm paying for my generative AI services versus not paid. And when you do have a subscription, because this might be a situation, if you, depending on what, you know, sensitivities are around your case, it may be a situation where you want to pay. So that in that environment, then you're really able to drill down on what you want shared or what you want the model to be able to use from what you are inputting into the system. So those are also some nuances as it relates to settings and subscription plans. Those things you can think about when you are putting your information into the system to try to help you provide a good strategy for whatever the thing is legally that you're representing yourself on. And also, it's important to, if there are specific like numbers of data that the generative AI is giving back to you, you want to be sure that you're double checking those stats and making sure that the source it says it is likely it's coming from, that you also check the actual real source and making sure it's accurate, because I have definitely had situations where the AI was making a mistake and I will actually get mad at it. Sometimes they're like, no, that is not what I asked you for. So I talk to her like it's a person, but it's not. And I'm like, no, repeat, I want it this way. And sometimes you have to do that because it will hallucinate and provide things that aren't actually true or aren't actually there. So it's important, particularly if you are someone in your field and you're just trying to find a way to streamline your ideas, even as you're working through some legal perspective, you want to make sure that you don't come off sounding like, excuse my French, like a goofball because you did not check the information that you got from you know, generative AI. And now you're, you know, let's say you're ready to present or read or whatever, and the information is incorrect just because you did not do a simple glance over or gloss over for something that you would know as an expert is not actually true. And those are the things that will keep you honestly out of hot water for yourself personally, and being able to have a sense of agency around your own information in these systems. And that would be, I'm going to, so just for your audience, one, think about operational security, meaning work to do your best not to put your PII, like your full names, whole names, your address, you know, maybe your family members, use fake names, use X's, use brackets as a way to ensure that you are minimizing that type of level of footprint from a social engineering perspective. Two, the other piece around this is making sure you are checking the data. If there are numbers in there, if there are certain words that you know that are specific to whatever it is that you're looking for, that one, those words are in there and that they're actually used correctly, or phrases or whatever that thing is. And then finally, you want to make sure that you are really thinking about what I get from these systems and how I'm actually going to use those, in, let's say, in a court of law, and if I actually want to present these in a court of law. And if so, then you probably also want to go back to some of the actual, like, you know, let's say a federal register or like the state, you know, laws, and making sure that you are capturing that from your state, or you know, if it's at the federal level, those type of things. And so those would be like the top things that I would say to definitely think about as you are, let's say, representing yourself. And it will save you thousands of dollars for sure if you are able to successfully balance that, you know, your privacy, your current situation, and being able to articulate exactly your point of view. I think that it can be leveraged in a way that really is, it levels the playing field for those who don't have the ability to get representation in a way that they see as equitable or that is the best representation for them.
I mean, that's actually a very technical, technically backed piece of advice that I think is incredibly clear that how much deep understanding you have of how large language models or AI is built and what it's doing under the hood. Just reminding the model to do things correctly is often is just part of the very practical advice, those several points you made. So Erica, thank you so much for all these technology national security and policy for technology and, you know, giving more insights to us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. This has been episode 9 of Tech and Law Insights. It's been excellent. I would certainly be thrilled to have you back in a future episode. It just seems like we've just touched on
what
we worked on.
Absolutely. I would love to come back, actually.
That would be great for our listenership and for me as well, honestly. So
yeah, I would love to be honored.
Love that. Thank you. For our listeners, I'm going to go ahead and link to Erica's speaking and policy work in the show notes. And if you enjoyed the conversation, please give us a follow and share episode 9 featuring expert technology policy and strategy leader Erica Shoemate. I'm Rupa from Lurie.ai, and we'll see you next time. Until then, keep innovating.